Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June the 13th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speakers are Mary Carlson and Dan Spencer, continuing their five-part series entitled Bioethics and Faith. Today, procuring organs for infants. Let's listen in.
This is the fourth in our series on bioethics and faith. Tonight's topic is organ donation from terminally ill infants, organ procurement from terminally ill infants. I'm Mary Carlson. I teach social work at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm beginning to teach some bioethics on the campus also. This is Dan Spencer, who teaches religion and ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. So we're happy you're all here. How many are new tonight to this series? Okay, a fair number of hands, then we'll, that's good. That helps us know sort of what to do here. Okay, let me just say that what we've done for the week is use each day a different case study to illustrate some what we hope to be common or soon to be more common issues that all of us may well face in healthcare in this country. And one of our major goals is to give us all some language in common, some terms in common, and some tools for facing these dilemmas when they arise. As I've said, we're not turning us all into ethicists, but we do want us to be able to talk to each other, and I think that's possible. I've had a fair number of you, and I'm sure Dan has too, come up and say, we had something like this in our family, or I'm going to leave the village and go talk to my family about something related to something we've said. One thing I would say about tonight's topic, it's on anencephalic infants, and there may well be people in the room who have had experience with that, and I urge us to just be respectful of everybody's experience, whatever people have lived with or lived through. I'm going to do a quick summary of some of the principles and of the model for decision-making that we're encouraging us to use together before we get into the case. So those of you who have heard me do this, or Dan do this, bear with me for the next few minutes. But we have a number of new people, and I just want them to feel a little up to speed. I'm not going to go over the common terms in ethics except to say what we're focusing on here are ethical dilemmas, and those are situations where duties, responsibilities, or principles conflict in some way. In other words, it is a dilemma that's difficult to solve. Let me just briefly mention particularly these first five principles that are commonly used in bioethics in this country as the primary principles usually to be looked at in a case. Most of them are grounded in a basic respect for persons, that individual people have value in and of themselves. And for those of us who are Christians, we can certainly live with that. As God's creatures, we have intrinsic value in and of itself. Persons, that means, can never be used as ends. Never be used as means to other ends. Related to these are non-maleficence. Some of you have heard this as do not harm. That means never intend to do harm to your patient. The flip side of non-maleficence being beneficence, generally speaking, to do good. Or in recent years, expanded even more to say we try to promote the whole well-being of our patients. And that means spiritual, social, psychological, as well as physical. Autonomy is viewed by some as the principle, if you will, in this Western country that focuses on individuals. Some argue about whether that should be the case. But we have gradually, over the last 20 years, focused a great deal of attention on individual patients' right to choose, right to self-determination, right to make my own decisions about my own life and death. And some of the cases we've done already this week have certainly borne that out. Some related concepts are informed consent. We need to know what it is we're consenting to or refusing in terms of medical treatment. Decision-making capacity, commonly called competency. Can I make the decision? Am I able to understand the consequences of refusing or taking a treatment? The notion of surrogacy, which is somebody speaking for somebody else, if that person can't make a decision, him or herself. And then related to that, justice, or the notion of fairness, treating equal situations or persons equally and unequal situations unequally, Generally, justice brings in the social dimension, a broader, more macro dimension, which we'll be talking about some tonight with the case. Then some of the other principles that flow from those include confidentiality, honesty, fidelity, utility, and burden benefit, some of which may come up tonight, but we urge you to take a look here at those.
I didn't mention utility, isn't it?
Oh, utility, yeah, is a pretty major one. Commonly understood by most of us as doing the greatest good for the greatest number. That will come into play tonight when we talk about the case. Maximizing well-being, social well-being in general. And then quickly, though this is one model of others, this is a commonly used model, six steps with two basic pieces to it. First is analyzing the specific situation. Second is analyzing it in terms of its moral dimensions. The first step we've been doing together each night, we will do that tonight, gathering relevant facts and information. Secondly, identifying the dilemma. Which principles are at play here, have bearing here, and do any of them, and which of them, conflict in what ways? Then looking at alternatives and consequences, choices we might make in this situation, keeping in mind that some are good and some are bad, some are short-term and some are long-term, and we need to expand our thinking. This is often where people jump to, or way down here, choosing a specific alternative. We're asking you to go through some steps first. After generating a few possibilities for action in a certain case, we ask you to evaluate that in light of which of these principles over here came into play in one of the earlier steps. I feel like I'm doing this. This is nice. We either do the jack-in-the-box up and down or the back and forth here. Fifth, assessing an underlying motive. What is it that people are really wanting to get out of the fact that they're taking this action in a particular case? Again, in light of the values or principles that are talked about up here in gathering relevant information. And last, and only last, choosing an alternative and justifying it. I will say that many of us will be faced with ethical dilemmas in which we have to make a quick decision. And sometimes we can't sit down with a group of our best friends or a group of ethicists like Dan Spencer, call them up and say, talk me through this, Dan. But we hope that if you've had time here, or any other place to sort of do this exercise, then when you are forced to make a choice, ethical choice, in the midst of a dilemma, you will make a better choice because you've had some exposure to thinking it through pretty carefully. Before we get into the case background, any questions about that from folks who are new? It's a, you know, intro course in philosophical ethics in 2 minutes. Whew. Any questions? We can come back to them if you have them too. Okay. Ready. Introduction of the case, yes.
All right. We're going to get you right into the case tonight, but let me give you a few background comments. One of the things we mentioned earlier in the week is that many biomedical dilemmas, ethical dilemmas, are coming about because of increases in technology, what technology can do. And it's only going to increase throughout our lifetimes. We're going to see more and more of these as technology makes different kinds of treatment more and more feasible. Tonight's issue is a good example of that. We're looking at the whole dilemma of increased ability to do infant organ transplants. Now, these are increasingly feasible, but the supply of infant organs has not kept up with the feasibility of doing these transplants. So the question then becomes, what kind of, when we start looking at the sources of infant organs, should we start to consider some other sources that previously have not been considered? And one case that's being debated quite a bit is the case of anencephalic infants. How many folks here are familiar that have heard the term anencephaly or anencephalic? Quite a few. Anybody want to give me a rough definition of what when we talk about an anencephalic infant, what are we talking about?
No brains.
An infant born without the main part of the brain. Now they still do have the brain cord through the area, and so there is still rudimentary function. So there still is breathing, so the organs can still function. This becomes important because there's enough of the brain present that they do not fit within the legal definition of brain dead. If they were totally without any brain there, the case would be much easier. They'd be simply just qualified as brain dead. But there's enough of the brain present that rudimentary organs, and with medical assistance, can be kept going, breathing can be kept going, and so forth. And so anencephaly brings up very difficult ethical issues there. Some things that are important to know about it. It can be diagnosed prenatally. both through sonograms, through ultrasounds, also through some other forms of testing. And so it is possible, in most cases still, if an anencephalic infant is diagnosed in the third trimester, a third trimester abortion is permissible. Although, of course, we're seeing this is one of the big issues being debated right now in the Congress about whether these abortions should still be permissible under these conditions. But currently, in most places, they are. Anencephaly is always terminal. There is no medical or biological chance for the child to develop to a point of consciousness or develop to a point of developing on its own. There have been some rare cases with intensive medical intervention where a child can be kept breathing and its organs functioning for up to a year. But in the vast majority of cases, anencephalic infants die in a matter of days, if not weeks. There is no treatment beyond this being able to, in some rare cases, and we can talk more about that later if people are interested in that, but it is always a fatal condition, and generally we're talking days to the most weeks. There usually are roughly 2,000 anencephalic babies born per year, and that becomes important in terms of the availability of organs. Currently, there are about 1,500 to 2,000 infants with organ needs each year. So almost a one-to-one match in terms of availability if anencephalic infants were considered as organ donors. And as I mentioned before, the critical factor is that currently they do not meet the criteria for brain death, which is one of the main criteria for which organ donation can take place. Okay. Now, questions on any of that before we give you the case, and we'll give a little bit more information as we go through the case. But, or does anybody have anything else they'd like to add in terms of that information? Yeah.
When you talked about the debate in Congress, is that the partial birth abortion?
Yes. Yeah, the so-called partial birth abortion, this has been one of the main cases where they have been used in cases of infants with anencephaly or sometimes the spina bifida, where the brain sac has been enlarged and there would be some potential harm to the mother to try and deliver the baby.
Is there a point at which the organs of the potential donor begin to deteriorate?
Very important point, yeah. And we'll talk about that a little bit in the case here. This is one of the critical things. If the infant is allowed to die a natural death, in that process, the organ quality usually deteriorates to a point where they're no longer usable. And that becomes a very critical factor. If you simply allow the infant to die, the organs, with the exception of a few things such as the corneas and the eyes, by and large are no longer viable.
Unlike last night, we're not assigning different roles in groups, but do, if you would, get in small groups of four or so as we pass this out, so we're doing two things at once. Whether you know somebody or not doesn't matter, but in groups of four would be great.
And would somebody hand four or five up to the folks upstairs in the balcony so we can get one group up there? I've got them here.
He's coming down.
Now, as these are going around, let me just mention, as we've done all along, these are actual cases. So what we'll be reading tonight is an actual case. We'll be able to tell you about the outcome of it.
So as Dan reads it for the tape, you can read along. But if you'd let him read it for the tape, that would be great.
Does everyone have one now? Did some get upstairs? Are there any extras that are going around here?
We brought 50, so we should be fine.
I think if you can get some in the back corner, just hand them upstairs.
No, they're not.
Oh, they're taking them upstairs. Okay. Okay. If you will just then read along with me read it so the tape can pick this up. In March 1992, a young Florida couple who had just given birth received devastating news. Their infant daughter, Teresa Ann, had been born with anencephaly, a congenital absence of a major portion of her brain, skull, and scalp. The doctors explained to them that Teresa Ann had no forebrain or cerebrum, and while she had a rudimentary functional brain stem, her lack of a functioning cerebrum meant there was no possibility of consciousness. Without medical intervention, anencephaly is quickly fatal. Even with intervention, most anencephalic babies die within a matter of months. After learning this and talking together, The parents decided that Teresa Ann's life would not be totally in vain if they could donate her organs so that another infant would have the possibility of life. They were aware that there is a shortage of organs small enough for newborns and infants in need, and felt that by donating Teresa's organs, there would be some meaning to her short life and death. Teresa's parents soon encountered a problem, however. The condition of anencephaly did not meet the legal definition of brain death, which is required for organs to be removed from a person's body. If they were to wait for Teresa to die, more than likely her organs would have deteriorated to the point of no longer being suitable for transplantation. When informed of this, Teresa's parents asked the court to declare their daughter legally dead, so that her organs could be removed and transplanted to other infants. The lower court refused their request, arguing that it would be illegal and unethical to cause death in an infant in order to remove its organs. The parents then appealed to the Florida Supreme Court. Now, what we would like you to do tonight is to work through the six steps here in order to get to these questions we have listed here, which I'll read for the tape again. First, where do you see the primary ethical dilemma in this case? What ethical principles are involved and why? Where do they conflict? That's step number two in the model. Secondly, what are the possible alternatives, both for this case and for future anencephalic babies? And what are possible or likely short and long-term consequences for each? Keeping in mind that bioethics operates oftentimes by precedent, and so this individual case can set precedent for future cases. Thirdly, finally, what do you finally decide? Should anencephalic babies be used, or be able to be used, for organ donation with their parents' consent? Why or why not? How do you justify your decision? Very good. So let's see, are there other questions here in terms of step one that either Mary or I could give you information about this particular case? Or do you have enough to proceed at this point?
It says without medical intervention. Does that mean food and water?
Food and water, putting on a ventilator to keep the lungs functioning. So
food and water is included in medical intervention.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what's needed to keep the brain functioning at the level it's functioning.
Enough to keep the lungs functioning and the organs functioning. Now, again, just one reminder that the anencephalic babies have no consciousness, no possible consciousness. That includes no sensing, so no feeling ability.
So they don't feel hungry, they don't feel thirsty.
Right. Don't feel pain.
Got the information you need? Go to it.
We'll give you about 20 minutes or so.
2 to 6 and focus specifically on 2 and 3. 4, if you can get to it, would be just great. Let's pull together here to the big group and make a decision fast. Somebody said we haven't given you any easy cases. I don't understand it. With this larger group, I'd like us to, in an orderly manner, get into this issue. So, the first thing I'm going to ask is that groups individually just spell out, call out, which principles have bearing on this case. Not even a dilemma yet. Which are the principles up here that have some bearing? Just call them out.
You got to survey the room there.
Survey the room. Over here.
Sanctity of life.
Sanctity of life.
Respect for persons.
Respect for persons.
Do not harm.
Do no harm. Write faster, Spencer.
They're supposed to have to say why these.
You say survey the group, and then you tell me to go into it. Okay. Sanctity of life. Whose life? What are we talking about?
That's where we got in an argument. The baby.
Okay. So right there, question mark. Sanctity of whose life, and is it a life?
Yeah,
is this not the question?
That's
one of the
right.
questions is like, okay, respect for persons. Why is that coherent? Does that have meaning?
Well, I think because the parents, I think, should be allowed to make the decision for their child in that situation.
Okay. And okay. So two things I think come up with that. The same issue: whose life are we having respect for? Respect for life, and do the parents have some autonomy here for the baby, for the being, for Teresa Ann in this? Yes. Anybody here? What did you say? Principles.
Utility.
I missed a third. Now on the left.
Utility too.
Okay, utility. Let's
Good, back up just a second. Non-maleficence?
Well, harming by taking the organs from the anencephalic baby versus the good of doing the recipient by giving minutes.
Okay, which is really the balance with utility here, is it not, in some ways? Do no harm to Teresa Ann. On the other flip side, we can help another being, another baby, perhaps, by taking the organs from
But you are talking about intentionally ending a life. Mm-hmm.
Which is harming if it's a life, right? That's the issue.
Terminating it.
Okay. Other principles, other groups?
What did somebody said utility?
Everything you mentioned, we also said burden benefit.
Burden benefit? Okay, talk about that for a minute.
Well, first of all, just simply from the cost of the patient, or for the parents, you know, keeping the baby alive.
Okay.
The mental anguish of not being that's connected with that.
Okay.
Yeah, mental anguish of both keeping the baby alive, but also, and then not being able to give the organ by not keeping the baby alive.
Okay. Right. Okay. And it generally, burden benefit corresponds particularly to the person we're talking about, Teresa Ann. In this case, it's difficult to know if there's any, what the burden or benefit is to her, yes, but we can expand it to the family some and talk about, their mental anguish too. Okay, good. Upstairs, did you have any to add that were different?
Well, it seems like the court and the parents are operating on two different levels. The court is operating in terms of precedence, and they're focused exclusively on that.
And what's the value or ethical principle that's the precedent, do you think? Is it up there?
I think they're operating from the sanctity of life,
right,
primarily.
I think so, true. Yeah, right. Good. And what might you say the parents are operating from?
I would think it's utility.
Okay, we're moving into a little dilemma here. Sanctity of life versus utility, right? That's one of the dilemmas. Good. Anybody else have other principles that aren't up here? Any of the groups? Okay.
But anybody talking all about beneficence, the duty to promote the whole well-being?
Yeah. Well, from my point of view, and I think they have consensus here, that in normal abortion, they say that it's not a living person, see. And in many cases, it could be a living person if it wasn't aborted. In this case, you've got a creature right out in front of you that does not live up to the concept of a living creature, of a living human being. In that they do not even have the capacity to find the mother's nipple and feed themselves.
This is a big issue that you're raising here. Does this infant qualify, does it have personhood?
Right.
When we talk about rights, ethical duties and rights, we're talking about these being invested in persons in a way that we don't usually talk about them in terms of the same rights for animals or other creatures, although we talk about animal rights. But we talk about a minimum level of personhood. Does this infant meet that criteria? And what are the implications of saying yes or no to that? One of the big issues.
We come to the conclusion.
Nope, don't tell us your conclusion yet. Hold on. Hold that thought, okay? Good. Don't lose it, though. Yeah.
On the issue of benefits, one thing I'm not, how tangible do we consider all the other potential lives that may be saved from these organ transplants?
Yeah, and that's a difficult question. Because organ transplantation is so recent, and I don't have with me, and some of you may have them, the data on how well certain organs are transplanted into certain other infants and how long do those infants live and what kind of life do they have. I don't have it. It's new enough, so there's not lots of data. And if you look at what did we have up here, 1,500 to 2,000 infants a year in the country, that's growing. More and more and more infants will be needing organs because they have the doctors and nurses who can do the transplants in little tiny babies.
Part of what's at stake here as well, this is a difficult one when you start looking at utility, the more, it sounds crass to say, but the more doctors are able to practice, the better they can improve the technologies. Mm-hmm. Now the AMA, the American Medical Association, is quite clear in its guidelines that experimental motives are always secondary to the autonomy and wishes of the patient, but it is
and
a factor.
Parents. And parents.
And
in
parents,
this case,
right.
Parents.
So we don't know for sure whether these would directly benefit another infant, but they would probably directly benefit the field, increasing the feasibility of either these or future operations.
And if it benefited the life of another infant, even for a day, a week, a month, a year, might quality of life then become an issue for that infant and his or her parents? If we can save a baby for a little while and hope that maybe it'll be longer, then that becomes important, an important principle, an ethical consideration. Okay, so the dilemma, we've come up with at least one. Where'd it go?
Sanctity of life.
Utility. Versus utility. Yeah. Any other conflict among these that you can see or that you came up with?
I think there's one conflict there on what is sanctity of life thing. I think that the parents have a different view of sanctity of life than the courts do. So that's a conflict between what, where is the sanctity in the life.
Okay. Definition of life and what sanctity of life means to people can be in conflict.
Well, her life would be sanctified to them if it could be used.
If it could be used for others, yeah. And a dilemma can be within one of these principles, and the principle sanctity of life has its own dilemma within it.
Or the reverse, we talked about the definition of death, and might it need to be redefined with modern technology as it is progressing? It's already been redefined.
Yeah, let's put that as an alternative, because one of the options that we can do is redefine brain death to include anencephalic infants as brain death. Currently, that's not the case. That would be an option. That will be something that the next President's Commission to determine brain death will decide on, and I suspect that will be soon with the increase in need.
I think there's a dilemma here that we surfaced a little in our discussion between the sanctity of life and the understanding of personhood.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, there's more than one ways to define personhood. And there's a sense in which that little baby may not be fully a person in the way we think of them, but there's a lot of human life that doesn't reach the full potential, but is still very meaningful to other persons around them. And so if your concept of personhood is more than the individual consciousness of an ego, mm-hmm. If it's a whole stream of life, then it's in conflict with this understanding of the sanctity of life as being related to an individual consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to make your mention of the medical center? The babies?
We'll come back to a little bit. But I would want to, part of what you're bringing up is what is a term that ethicists often talk about, the danger of a slippery slope. Once you start moving away from an absolute, that is, the moment this baby is outside the womb and is present, once you start making exceptions to whether or not it's a person, where do you draw the line? Okay, now we say anencephalic. What about spina bifida? What about, these are often spectrums of conditions. Mm-hmm. And so at what point, if it has 30% brain function, if it has 50% brain function, you start running into these very difficult things about
profoundly developmentally disabled children who will have essentially no consciousness about life that we define.
But maybe viable.
Yeah.
I've had to be ripped in and out of this session, so I hope it's okay if I make a comment.
You have a spouse next door.
I do. I had to go over there. What keeps coming up for me on this issue of personhood for this child is that as Christians, it could be that we could say to ourselves that the finest way we could acknowledge the personhood of this child would be to allow her to make the kind of sacrifice, and I mean this in the highest possible way, to her brothers and sisters. This brings her into full personhood in our community.
But
yes.
This is why it's a dilemma.
Yes, please.
Well, I'm not sure it exactly responds to that, but I think if I were a parent having to make this decision now, I would have a sort of faith issue that would say the most comfort that I can get is holding this child, letting it give to me and me to it whatever I can, and letting God decide when its life is finished. Instead of having me, say, chop into it and take out its liver.
Would any of you have been slightly swayed if we'd had the parents say we are deeply committed Christians and this notion of
sacrifice of our child for the benefit and good of another, if we said that in here, added it, might that have swayed somebody? Yeah, something to think about. But this is the other. Isn't God in charge here?
So Ingrid, in your sense, you're saying let God slash nature take its course. Mm-hmm. And don't play God slash nature. Is that fair?
Yeah. At the same time, I wouldn't want tubes and feeding tubes or anything, probably.
Yeah. Well, and we came up with, because we got about, at what point do you decide to remove life from what kind of thing? And I said, when it gets to be torture for the individual, stroke patients, whatnot. When you have to strap anybody in bed and feed them through a nose, I think it's inhumane and you're inflicting torture on them. I think that is the time to stop. And I feel almost that same way about this, may I call it a soul?
That's the question.
Yeah, okay.
Call her Teresa Ann, they named her, yeah.
None of us really care about that body. What we are caring about is the soul.
I think some are caring about the soul, and some care very much about the body, like his parents. They care very much about using her body as a means.
Yeah.
Respect for persons says we can't do that. They're saying, is this really a person? Okay. And we debated about bringing up this other related case of Baby K, who many of you heard about, the separate issue, flip side. Baby K is born with anencephaly. The mother says, out of my deep faith in God, I believe we do everything to sustain my daughter. And that means respirator and tube feeding and treat every bout of pneumonia. She's the one who lived a year in and out of the hospital in a nursing home. And the hospital went to court to say, this is futile treatment. This is not medically useful. It is not of benefit here. And she said, I am a Christian. And this baby will be kept alive as long as we have the means to do it. And they did for a year before she died.
Well, when we bring God into it, well, then we have to look at David and Bathsheba's first child. And David cried quite a bit, hoping that the child would live, but God had to die.
Yeah, that was a long time before we had the ability to keep going. That their brain stem functions sort of intact. But we do have to bring in.
That's the concept of God, doesn't it?
Yeah, and people can argue about
but,
that.
One thing God did, he gave a certain number of human beings the ability to learn how to use organs from this non-functional child.
Yeah.
And so God has got this whole bevy of people who can do something wonderful.
And one of the kids who could get the organ might, solve the AIDS dilemma.
And as we get to Dan, let me just remind you, we're trying to get as many of the alternatives that have come out in your groups. Have we exhausted all the alternatives that you came up with, or are there others out there? So far, we have redefined brain death to include anencephaly, deny personhood, which would allow you to then go in and take the organs, or simply to let God or nature take its course.
But see, even that one, some people may say, well, God is giving these recipient families the opportunity to have a life, so what that course is isn't clear. I think we mean it to say, just let the baby die naturally, but other people may not interpret that as God's will.
Mm-hmm. And naturally is different for different people.
Yeah.
If we have the ability to feed, that's natural, we should feed them.
A baby can't feed itself,
right.
Even a healthy term baby would.
What else could we do here?
How about partial term abortion?
This baby's been born already. This baby's out of the womb.
Yeah, that is an option in utero. My understanding is, though, if you do a partial term abortion, you can't take those organs. Is that accurate to say?
That I don't know.
I believe that's the case.
It's a partial term. Are they not developed enough?
It's third trimester. No, they're quite developed.
But it's illegal to me?
No, it's legal. But to essentially kill the being in utero in third trimester to extract it, or you do some inject a saline solution so that the mother goes into labor and delivers a baby that has died or is dying. And I suspect because one of the issues is how long infant organs function. They're so small. But there's a quick, you need to get them quickly and transplant them more quickly than bigger organs in adults. I think that for non-medical people, like me, it makes some sense.
Given our time, Mary, I wonder if we should simply pull the groups. Although, Dan, you had a hand up. Did you want to bring up something?
Well, it's probably too much of an issue. I'm sitting here dwelling on the limited resources we have for health care and all the families that don't even have basic health care. And they, as a parent, I guess, a tremendous moral dilemma of pain when so many people don't have any healthcare.
This was the argument that the hospital made in the Baby K case, because they ended up spending over $500,000. And the hospital said, this is by medical definition futile care. There's no benefit. Therefore, we should not be forced to do this. But the court said, no, this is an area of parental discretion.
Yeah, and ought the parents in this case be able to say, look, we're concerned about all the babies who aren't getting immunizations, about all the preemies who have a chance of life and consciousness and interaction. Therefore, we are taking this stance. That's an extension. If Teresa Ann is an autonomous being, it's an extension of her autonomy to have the parents make that choice and that decision. And that is the if. But then, if that's true, then the parents have the legal right and moral responsibility to make that choice.
The problem that I can see coming up with this is if a woman finds out in the middle of the pregnancy that she's carrying an anencephalic child and is then pressured to carry the child to term in order to give the child their organ donation.
The slippery slope part two.
And that's a very real possibility.
Well, there was a story about on TV about that just a few days ago. I've seen the lady was told in somewhere after 6 months that there was going to be an anencephalitic child, and she decided to carry it to term, and the baby died within an hour of it being born. But they were happy to have been able to hold it themselves. But my perception of that on one of your other concepts up there is that it may would have been more practical for pragmatic purposes to allow the baby's organs to have been used for some other baby.
And part of it, as you bring up here, these kinds of situations bring into people's deepest beliefs and values about life. And for many, simply holding that infant is the best value.
Why don't you do the final 2 points? What happened to the case and the AMA's stance on it?
Let me just do a quick thing now. How many folks think it would be ethical to either, well, when we did this case, there are three options, basically. One is to intentionally end Teresa's life, to end the baby's life, and that increases the highest degree of viability for the organs to be good. The second is to keep the baby respirated and medically done until a point where you can allow it to die naturally and then quickly harvest it. And the third is to simply not intervene and let the baby die, which would have the least ability, least likelihood of having good organs. In terms of these three here, how many folks think it would be ethical to have the highest degree of viability? That is, either through
like
redefining brain death, but...
And the parents determine this?
The parents determine this. Parents want this. Would it be ethical for them to end Teresa's life in order to have the best ability to have the organs viable?
What's the degree of difference between inviability between 1 and 2?
Yeah. It goes down rapidly. The longer the baby is in the process of deterioration all the way along. So the longer it's kept alive, the more the organs deteriorate.
So, and that's going to be different for every individual baby.
Yeah.
I don't know the specifics. But.
Yeah.
So how many, show of hands, say that these parents have an ethical...
It would be within an ethical...
Yeah. I'm going to bring up another issue. If they, have a match for this child, and I know that the baby's organs are going to go to somebody, I'm more apt to vote for... having that happen, but if they're going to save it without knowing that there's a use for those organs, I don't want that.
Yeah, and I can't speak specifically to it except to say I'd be surprised if there wasn't an immediate match.
Oh,
I have a friend who works in organ donation in Minneapolis, and she says that every child abuse case, a shaken baby syndrome, or another baby with a head injury, which is where they get most infant organs right now, they are like... horrified and thrilled because there is always an immediately waiting baby because of the ability now to transplant. So
how much match do they have to do? I mean, the baby is, an infant, its immune system isn't
Well, you're the micro, whatever you are, biologist. You tell us then, Jane. Come on, I don't know. That's a social worker.
Maybe immune system isn't fully developed in age two. So an infant would seem to be a very likely candidate without a great match.
So there you go. More likely that you'd find somebody.
Let me just tell you, since we're getting close to the end of our time here, a few things about this case. When the family appealed it to the higher level court, the higher level agreed with the lower level. Would not allow them to terminate Treason's life. The baby eventually did die. The organs were not viable. They were able to take the corneas, the eyes, but that was all they were able to salvage from Treason's case. So that is still, in that sense, the legal precedent. Now, a couple other things. The American Medical Association has their own ethical stand or stance on this, and this is what they say. They say it is ethically permissible to consider the anencephalic infant as a potential organ donor, although still alive under the current definition of death, only if it has three conditions. One, the diagnosis of anencephaly is certain and confirmed by two physicians who are not part of the organ transplant team. Secondly, the parents of the infant desire to have the infant serve as an organ donor and indicate such in writing. And third, there's compliance with the general guidelines for transplantation of organs, which is elsewhere. Now, listen, they say, an alternative, a family wishing to donate of their the organs of their anencephalic infant may choose to provide the infant with ventilator assistance and other medical therapies that would sustain organ perfusion and viability until such time as determination of death can be made in accordance with current medical standards and relevant law. That is, keep the infant alive until it dies a natural death.
On machine. Natural death. Like this baby Kay did. She was in and out, in and out, in and out for pneumonia. At some point, you can't do it anymore.
In this situation, the family must be informed of the possibility that the organs might deteriorate in the process, rendering them unsuitable for transplantation. It is normally required that the donor be legally dead before permitting the harvesting of the organs. The use of the anencephalic infant as a live donor is a limited exception to the general standard because of the fact that the infant has never experienced and will never experience consciousness. So what the AMA essentially is doing is expanding brain death definition in this case alone to include anencephalic, but it still means that you're taking the organs out while the baby is technically alive. Now, one last thing I want to mention about this is that I know of at least one situation where a medical center was using anencephalic babies to procure organs for a period of time, and eventually they stopped. And the main reason they stopped is that the personnel involved in the care of these infants began to have very strong emotional reactions, even though they knew intellectually that these infants had no possibility of life. Most anencephalic babies are normal looking to appearance. Some of them have brain deformities, but many of them simply have an empty cavity, and so as they lie there, they look like a normal infant. And what was happening is the nursing teams and the care teams were bonding with these infants until their organs were taken. And this eventually became such an emotional burden on the hospital that they stopped the policy from doing it. So very difficult ethical decision about this particular case, and I think we will.
I think we need to end, and if people want to keep chatting, they can. But the table.
How long does she live?
Just a few more days, 2 to 3 days. One last thing, just to mention: tomorrow morning we'll be doing the fifth of the session. Another relatively recent or new case, and that is with the increasing ability to do genetic testing. Should children be told about should they be tested, and then should they be told if they have a potential for a genetic condition in the future? So we'll be looking at a case around that.
Neurofibromatosis, type 1. You don't have to know about all that. We'll tell you. We're learning.
Our goal, I think,
nice
is, as we said before, we hope that we're starting conversations rather than ending them. But people will be talking to each other ahead of time. The more you can prevent on these unfortunate conversations from later happening, the better.
Is there any way to get copies of these other than we copying ourselves or taking a picture of it?